Well, have you guessed his name? Of course, it's right there in the title. And later he calls himself, or says you can call him, Lucifer. He's also been known by names like Belial and Beelzebub and the Evil One. On Halloween, we can see around us images of the devil and his colorful entourage of witches, ghouls, goblins, ghosts, vampires, and zombies. You may recall President George W. Bush used to refer to Osama bin Laden as the Evil One, essentially equating bin Laden with the devil. You may also remember the distasteful, at least it was to me, rejoicing in the streets of some Americans when bin Laden was killed. But this indicates that many people, in fact, did see him as some kind of a devil. Although the Rolling Stones song is called Sympathy for the Devil, bin Laden was hardly someone we can have much sympathy for. After all, he masterminded and trained people for the terrible tragedy of 9/11, as well as other terrorist events. He routinely called for the death of Americans and the destruction of America, which he called the symbol of paganism. And he did it all in the name of religion. To many Americans, bin Laden was the evil one, or at least one of the evil ones. But is there such a thing, really, as an evil person? A flesh and blood human devil? Decent people everywhere can't help but ask, who could possibly do such things as deliberately try to kill innocent people by hijacking jets and crashing them into buildings filled with thousands, or beheading journalists, as members of ISIS have done? These must be evil people, at least some would conclude. In 1983, psychiatrist Scott Peck wrote a controversial book in which he stated that there really are evil people. He called them people of the lie, and he suggested that evil should be classified as a mental illness, a personality disorder. He was not referring to psychopaths or sociopaths who don't distinguish between right and wrong. The ones that Peck was calling evil are people who do know the difference between right and wrong and yet choose to do evil, and then lie to others and even to themselves about their evil deeds. Well, considering people to be evil really seems to be antithetical to our Unitarian Universalist sensibilities. Our first Unitarian Universalist principle states it clearly. We covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Does that mean the inherent worth and dignity of Osama bin Laden, of Hitler, of ISIS leaders who behead people as a public spectacle? Our first principle makes no exceptions. But what does the inherent worth and dignity of every person actually mean? This first principle is a response to the old Calvinist notion that people are depraved sinners dangling like spiders over the burning cauldron of hell, to use the image of a famous 18th century evangelist. Historically, Calvinists and their religious descendants have asserted that we are essentially born bad because of the sin of Adam. Unitarian Universalists have countered that we are born innately, inherently good and worthy. This optimistic belief in humanity's basic goodness is so ingrained in most of us that it almost amounts to an unspoken UU creed. In fact, we Unitarian Universalists have been criticized for many decades for being Pollyannas about humanity and its evil doing, for having, you might say, an inadequate theology of evil. A few years ago, I came across a startling statement by the late well-known theologian and Unitarian Universalist, Charles Hartshorne. A colleague of mine, Jack Bryant, once mentioned the first Unitarian Universalist principle in a sermon, and theologian Hartshorne happened to be in the congregation that day. Hartshorne later came up to Jack and said to him, "The inherent worth and dignity of every person is nonsense, absolute nonsense." This from a Unitarian Universalist theologian. Hartshorne was part of the process school of modern theology, which asserts that God and human beings and all entities, down to the smallest microbe, are in process, changing and evolving together, and that all beings are radically free. Nothing is predetermined, and even God does not know the future or control the unfolding of the universe. In this view, God is not absolute good. God is process, the creative potential in an open, non-determined universe. So what I would guess that Hartshorne meant in pronouncing the belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person as nonsense is that from a process point of view, there is no inherent good or evil. Both the religious liberals and the Calvinists are wrong, a process theologian might say. Instead, we are born neutral, and we are free to choose to do good or evil. Those we might consider evil people are those who choose the evil more often over the good. Hartshorne would probably have had no problem with our first principle if it said, "We affirm and promote the potential worth and dignity of every person." Well, personally, I respect and treasure and even quote our first principle from time to time, and I believe that, as stated, it does inspire us to see the worth and dignity in all people. But from a philosophical or ontological point of view, I would have to side with Charles Hartshorne. I believe that by our choices, which we make every moment, we can mold our corner of the universe into a creative and life-affirming or a destructive and death-promoting event. And our choices in this moment create the universe of the next moment. To me, it matters in an ultimate sense how we choose. If I choose to take out some frustration on someone I love by jumping on him or her for some little transgression, if I want to strike out in revenge at someone who I believe has hurt me, or, on the other hand, if I return love, understanding, and forgiveness for hate, anger, and hurtfulness, well, these everyday choices that we have, that we all have, and that we all make, ultimately matter. As the Hebrew scriptures put it, the choice is ours. I set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that you and your children might live. The process theologian David Griffin asserts that before human beings came along, there was no demonic power at work on our planet. Griffin asks, but why would, in his theology, why would God provide the conditions for the emergence of the demonic? And then he answers, it is inherent in the nature of reality that creatures with the capacity for the creation and enjoyment of the highest values must also have the capacity for the greatest destruction. To be capable of the conscious pursuit of truth, beauty, and goodness is to be capable of the demonic, so Griffin would say. To me, the most poignant line in the Rolling Stones song is, I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys, when after all, it was you and me. The song acknowledges the evil potential in all of us. For me, that song is not about the devil out there, but about the one in here. We have certainly seen the demonic emerge in recent times and unleash its devastation upon all of us in the form of religiously based terrorism. But such terrorists believe that we're the demons and that they are on the side of God and of right. We may have a hard time believing that others actually hate us in part because of who we are, because of our freedoms. Religious and individual freedom is not a value that they share. On the contrary, their ideal society has little individual and religious freedom. It requires total conformity to what they believe is the will of God. And I am speaking of fundamentalists of many stripes and Islamic militants, not the Islamic people as a whole, by any means. But they don't value what the same thing we value, and we have a hard time wrapping our minds around that because we take our freedom so much for granted. Deep inside, though, perhaps so deep that they are not conscious of it, I imagine that they might feel some contradiction here between what they believe is right and good and what they do sometimes. I am reminded of the words of Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He recorded some of his thoughts while in prison in the Gulag Archipelago, and he wrote these words. It was granted to me to carry away from my prison years on my bent back this essential experience, how a human being becomes evil and how good. In the intoxication of youthful successes, I felt myself to be infallible, and I was therefore cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supported with systematic arguments. And it was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, not between political parties either, but right through every human heart. This line shifts. Inside us, it oscillates with the years. And even with hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an unrooted corner of evil. I find it helpful to view the question of human evil through the lens of Jungian psychology. Carl Jung spoke of the shadow personality within each of us, that part of us which represents scary, unrecognized, unfavorable, nefarious, or negative qualities. On Halloween, we see the shadow all around us in the form of little ghosts and goblins and devils and monsters. These traditional images that survive in the form of Halloween costumes are, Jung would say, external projections of the shadow in our psyche. To the ancient Celts, who lit bonfires on hilltops at Halloween to attract the good and ward off the evil spirits, The ghosts and goblins were real beings. The shadow personality in each of us can become conscious, but our egos tend to fight against it, to repress it as it emerges into awareness. Because our shadows are generally parts of ourselves that we are ashamed of. Shadow qualities vary from one individual to the next. They can be such uncomfortable attributes as egotism, greed, selfishness, laziness, lust for power or vengeance, cowardice, impulsiveness, irresponsibility. Jung calls the battle between the ego and the shadow the battle for deliverance. In mythology, this battle is expressed as a contest between an archetypal hero or heroine and the cosmic forces of evil in the form of demons, dragons, and monsters. Ancient stories such as Theseus and the Minotaur, Perseus and Medusa, St. George and the Dragon, these are all projections of this inner psychic struggle. Though the ego battles hard to keep the shadow submerged, it is important that we try to recognize it when it reveals itself, for example, through our dreams, or through feelings we have that surprise us with their intensity. If you find yourself intensely, perhaps irrationally, disliking someone, you may be unconsciously projecting some aspect of yourself, your shadow self, onto that person. If you feel rage welling up inside you when someone criticizes you for a fault you haven't really fully recognized in yourself, that person may have unwittingly named a part of your shadow for you. If we don't try to acknowledge our shadow selves, the qualities we're not proud of, the misdeeds and destruction we are capable of, these shadows are likely to emerge inappropriately and do damage to those we love or to ourselves. As Jung defined it, evil is the failure to meet the shadow. There is a collective aspect to this shadow dynamic. Groups, cultures, even nations have shadow personalities that they project onto their adversaries, making them into devils. It's clear that this is what the terrorists who destroyed the World Trade Towers did to us Americans. They demonized us. We, with our freedoms and our diversity and our modern lifestyles and attitudes, we are their shadow side. We are what they are afraid of. But what is our shadow side? We are not demons. In fact, we are a bright beacon of individual freedom for much of the world. But we have done things as a nation that we can't be proud of. Our shameful history of slavery, our continuing racism and injustice, our overuse of the world's resources and the resulting ecological damage, our propping up of repressive regimes, which sometimes comes back to haunt us. The more honestly we look at our own destructive tendencies, our shadow side, the more likely we will turn toward more positive solutions and possibly the fewer enemies we will make in the future. Although I suspect that no matter what good we do, there will be those who will continue to despise us for what we symbolize to them. So, who is the evil one? What's his name? Is it Bin Laden? Is it Hitler? The ISIS terrorists? What is evil? Is it a diagnosable illness? Is it the shadow? Is it ultimately you and me, as the Rolling Stones song suggests? One thing I do believe is that it lies crouching in the human heart as a potential. It is strong and it is often tempting. As former New York Mayor LaGuardia once said, "The devil is easy to identify. He appears when you are terribly tired and makes a very reasonable request which you know you shouldn't grant." We have all succumbed to the demon within at times, perhaps in small ways, but enough to know that it is there within us. But this I also believe. The evil one inside us may be strong, but it flees from compassion. It shrinks in the face of hope, and it is much, much weaker than love. The choice is ours to make.